It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The capture of ousted Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro over the weekend has triggered a wave of reactions across the world and here in Wisconsin.
Maduro appeared in federal court on Monday in New York City. He pleaded not guilty to federal drug trafficking charges.
Reactions to the Trump administration's military operation are divided. Some are praising the removal of Maduro from power. Others are protesting the U.S. military raid. These are sounds from the Wisconsin State Capitol on Saturday.
No blood! No blood for oil!
That audio from WORT in Madison. In just a bit, we'll hear from a professor of rhetoric about the potential impact of President Trump's hardline language toward Maduro and Venezuela.
First, we're joined by Patrick Iber, an associate professor of history at UW-Madison who studies 20th century Latin America and U.S. foreign relations. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
In that clip of the protest in Madison, we heard the chant, "No blood for oil." The White House said that its military operation was justified in part by Venezuela having stolen U.S. oil. Can you talk about the words in the chant and the relation to oil as Venezuela has the biggest oil reserves in the world?
Sure. President Trump has been quite explicit that recovering what he describes as stolen oil was part of the picture that led him to make this decision. I am joining you from Santiago, Chile at the moment, and here on the morning after Maduro's arrest, there's a large Venezuelan diasporic population here in Chile. About 1 million Venezuelans live here now, having fled Maduro's regime, and they were out honking horns and celebrating in public. So, the mood was very different from the one that you captured there in your audio in Madison.
Yeah. Can you help us lay the groundwork here? What has been the U.S. historical attitude toward Venezuela through time?
Towards Venezuela and towards Latin America in general, the U.S. has often had a kind of paternalistic and interventionist attitude. This is what the protesters are responding to. They know that that there's a long history of U.S. interference in Latin America to overthrow governments that it doesn't like, to act in ways that correspond to its interests rather than the interests of those countries. And so, while there were, as I said, Venezuelans who have suffered because of Maduro and his regime celebrating that moment, I understand and share the concerns of others who are worried that this represents a kind of new attitude of dominance that Trump is trying to project in the region.
But there are many other countries with an authoritarian regime in the world or other countries that traffic drugs into the U.S. Why specifically Venezuela?
Yeah, this is exactly right. In fact, Trump just pardoned the former president of Honduras, who was convicted of drug trafficking, saying that he was targeted by the Biden administration unfairly. He didn't do his homework at all on that. That was a very fair conviction. And Trump is impulsive in 100 different ways. Why Venezuela? I think Venezuela worked as at the convergence of interests within the Trump administration. If you think about the different constituencies that could be served by this action, on the one hand, okay, Trump says it's about oil, we'll take his word on that. For Marco Rubio, of course, with his political base in South Florida, removing the authoritarian but nominally left-wing governments of Nicaragua, Venezuela, and especially Cuba is a goal of long standing. And I assume that Cuba will be very much in their eyes next. And then for somebody like Stephen Miller, if changes in Venezuela make it possible to deport Venezuelans from the United States, then that serves his eliminationist agenda with respect to deportation. So I think that Venezuela was a choice that where there was like a convergence of different streams that make up the Trump administration. That's why they made that their first target.
So these military actions over the weekend, they might bring up comparisons to previous interventions in South and Central America, like the invasion of Cuba, Bay of Pigs. It could be, you know, invasion of Panama in 89 to overthrow General Manuel Noriega. Are there, you know, useful comparisons here, or what is what we're seeing right now totally different?
Well, it's certainly not totally different. And, you know, and Trump even, it used to be something that people would hide from. Like President Obama declared the end of the Monroe Doctrine, saying this sort of heavy-handed U.S. interventionism should be a thing of the past. Trump has talked about what I find totally embarrassingly calls the Dunroe Doctrine, that of reassertion of U.S. rights to interfere. He seems to sort of embrace the idea of being a kind of hemispheric power. But many people will experience that as hemispheric bullying and will respond accordingly. Already, the government of Mexico, for example, lodged a complaint at the United Nations saying that this action was a violation of Article 2 of the United Nations prohibiting the, you know, the interventions in the sovereignty of other countries. So we'll have to see. I mean, there is a lot of Maduro is very unpopular throughout the region, including among governments, certainly of the right and of the center. But to a certain degree, he's was unpopular on the left, too, because he was such a kind of weight around the regional left. And so I think that the response, such as it is, isn't going to be about the defense of Maduro in particular, but about the principles of sovereignty, which Trump is explicitly declaring are not interesting to him.
Patrick, thank you for this context. Thank you for joining us from Chile.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Patrick Eiber, Associate Professor of History at UW-Madison. Now for a look at President Trump's hardline language he uses toward Maduro in Venezuela. We called up Sarah McKinnon, a professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What have you been noticing in the White House's rhetoric surrounding Venezuela in the lead up to this weekend's military capture of Maduro?
You know, I think what's really fascinating about this moment is the staging that's happened before this, rhetorically, discursively, to get us to this moment. And so if we think about the way in which we've continued to hear more about narco-terrorism as a problem in the region, as a problem in Venezuela, this really begins in some ways with the 2020 indictment of Maduro on grounds of narco-terrorism, and then the staging of narcotics and the narcotics industry as a terrorist organization. So cartels in Mexico, cartels connected to Colombia as terrorist organizations. This staging work really gets us to the moment where we are today. Really, when we look at the action that happened on Saturday, in explicit terms, it was a law enforcement action, as the administration is articulating it, to address narco-terrorism. And so this part, I think, is really important. Now, those who are in opposition to this framing would maybe think about the action more as a military action or an action of war, an action of intervention. And so here, as a scholar who studies what words do, how words matter in the world, I think we have a really interesting moment.
In this moment, we heard President Trump say plans to run Venezuela now that his administration has captured President Maduro. That word run, it has been all over and it's causing confusion. What do you make of the phrase, you know, whether it's run or we're in charge?
Yeah, I think that caught the ears of many, many experts in the U.S. as well as internationally. This is something new that we have heard. You know, as Patrick Eiber discussed a moment ago, interventions, actions like what happened on Saturday are not new in some ways. Panama, Iraq, Grenada, we can think of moments to track back to. But what did seem new is the phrasing of run Venezuela. Now, of course, Marco Rubio has kind of moved us back a little bit on that and said that the administration will be working with the Venezuelan now president Delcy Rodriguez to oversee what's happening, but it'll be interesting to see what that looks like in the next few weeks, in the next few months, what the coordination, the involvement looks like. And of course, we have also heard further threats from the administration that if they don't do what the U.S. wants, there may be more military action.
Sarah, bringing this all back to Wisconsin, could President Trump's hardline rhetoric that we're hearing, could it affect Venezuelan immigrants who have made a life here?
Yeah, I think that's a really significant point to think about. There are many Venezuelan individuals, families in Wisconsin, in the United States, some with permanent residency, some who are now citizens, but many who are not, many who are in precarious status in terms of their ability to stay in the U.S. And so I think we're going to have to pay attention to what happens in relation to the immigration rhetoric that's also present, the refugee and immigration rhetoric. As Professor Eber mentioned a moment ago, Stephen Miller's interest in moving immigrants out of the United States, I think, is in line with what we're seeing. And so we could see a push to really suggest that Venezuelans who have arrived a few years ago must now return to Venezuela. I think that is definitely on many people's minds right now.
Sarah, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sarah McKinnon is a professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture in the Department of Communication Arts and faculty director of Latin American, Caribbean, and Iberian Studies at UW-Madison. And earlier, we heard from UW-Madison Associate Professor of History, Patrick Iber. We've been talking about the U.S. military operation in Venezuela and the possibility of other overseas interventions.
Coming up, tech companies are investing hundreds of billions of dollars in new data centers, and these projects are popping up all over Wisconsin. What is the risk of overbuilding?
These companies have a lot of projects going in a lot of places. So if they got to a point where they felt like they needed to pull back some of their investment, you could see that impact certain communities.
The AI data center boom and the impact on Wisconsin, that's coming up. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Recently, three Democratic U.S. senators sent a letter to the largest data center companies inquiring about the industry's impact on local communities.
These tech companies that got that letter, like Microsoft and Meta, have data center projects here in Wisconsin. The senators want to know whether the AI data center boom is causing electricity prices to soar, and they want a response from those companies in less than a week.
In just a bit, we'll hear from the advocacy group, Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin, about how the financial future of the AI industry might impact utility customers here in the state, especially if they expected returns on these massive investments in AI and they're not realized.
But first, data center deals surged to a record high last year. Analysts don't see a slowdown in demand for AI. What happens if too many data centers are built in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
To get the financial picture, we turn to Dan Gallagher, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street, where he covers the technology and media industries. Dan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Data center deals, they are going down here in Wisconsin and, of course, all over the country with billions of dollars that are flowing into the AI data center industry. And that really brings up questions of debt and risk and the word bubble. So can you talk about what is a bubble and how it can be identified?
Well, a bubble is kind of this loose term that refers to this, to something that, like, it's rapidly, something that's grown rapidly and it, frankly, is in danger of popping because bubbles do tend to pop. When we use it in terms of market and finance, it usually means like you've had this rush of investment into something that is pushing up valuations, making the companies worth more, even if they're not economically worth that much more. And when you have that kind of situation, there's obviously a danger of if circumstances change or if even investors like lose confidence in the story, you could have, that bubble burst.
The surge of money that is flowing into these projects, it does have some investors concerned over this rapid expansion of projects and then the return on investment in the future. From your reporting, are there indications that there will be a payday on these AI data center projects?
I look at it. There's a couple ways to look at it. And so it's a little more complicated for me. I think overall, there's a strong economic return that you're going to see with AI. I do think it's kind of on the order of the mobile phone revolution, the internet revolution. It's going to be it's a very significant technology but in both of those cases as well, we also saw times where there was like either certain companies, didn't pan out or certain ideas didn't pan out. The investments turned down a bit. We saw that famously with the dot-com burst. Mm-hmm. That did not change the fact that the internet was a very disruptive and technology that changed, almost everything really. But it took longer than some of the proponents thought. And there was obviously some pain in the interim. I think we can see that with AI. I do think there's a reason for some of these really big companies to like push investment into this because they see this as the next frontier of technology that they want to get ahead of. But because it's a very competitive, there's a competitive aspect to it. There's reason to think that if one of them pulls significantly ahead, the others will be permanently behind. That's what's sparking this rush of like who can spend the most to get most data centers up and get, AI models developed, quicker to be in like a leading position for that.
And there are the household names, the big names like the Amazons and the Microsofts, who have a lot of capital. But there are also these new companies trying to get in on the data center boom. How much are these firms borrowing and who is lending to them?
Well, they're having no problem finding lenders at the moment. The question now is, are they having to pay? What kind of interest rates are they getting? As the stocks kind of, we've seen this with a company called CoreWeave, which is sort of a new company in the space, and they've had to. Investors have lost kind of confidence, some confidence in that the. Of what the company's doing. So you've seen the stock take a major hit over the past few months. It's down by about half. And so what a company in that position is facing is, they can still get financing, but they might have to pay more, pay higher interest rates, which of course affects their economic model because they're still a company that's technically losing money and burning cash while they try to build this out. On the other hand, like you mentioned, you have these really, really big companies, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, that produce a lot of cash, but they're also spending a lot. They're spending a lot in raw dollar amounts and in a way that's affecting their own free cash flow and has affected most of their stocks as well, because now the investors are a little bit concerned. They'll still be around even if the AI bubble bursts. But investors are worried about, is there going to be a return on this massive amount of investment that you're making? And that's been a concern in the markets for the last 3 months.
I go back to this Morgan Stanley analysis recently that said the debt used to fund data centers could top $1 trillion by 2028. That is right around the corner. I mean, if you're a small community here in Wisconsin and a data center development is coming to town, should you be concerned about the high debt load of these projects?
It's something to think about for sure. There's the very real possibility that a lot of the projects that have been announced, and I'm not taking any position on a particular one, whether it's Wisconsin or somewhere else.
Sure.
But you have these companies have a lot of projects going in a lot of places. So if they got to a point where they felt like they needed to pull back some of their investment, because maybe the return is not going to happen as fast as they think it is. You could see that impact certain communities. If a project that was promised or even partially underway got got pulled back or stopped. That's definitely possible. And if you have, and if you have some of these projects that are backed with high loads of debt, as opposed to high, you know, the big cash flow of some of these really big companies, the risk is the same to the community in the sense that you might see projects that were promised that don't materialize.
If data centers would be overbuilt, how might these companies that invested heavily in the industry react and adapt? And then what should local residents be watching for in these projects?
Well, I think for some of the big companies that already had a lot of big data center networks, they feel they'll still be able to make use of these projects. If they put up a data center for AI computing and they decide, and there's not quite the demand to fill it, they think over time they'll still be able to make use of it because, you know, the companies like Microsoft and Google and Amazon and Oracle run already have these really big cloud computing operations where they provide, you know, essentially computing services to businesses. They've been doing this for years. So they have existing businesses that can make use of that infrastructure. It just may be that they can make use of it for a long time and not have to build a lot of new stuff if AI demand doesn't materialize the way they think.
You've been covering the tech industry for decades. Do you see any red flags at this point in this data center boom?
Well, red flags, I think, are, you know, I've seen a lot of times in technology where the optimism gets, you know, what I'll say a little bit overheated or out of control because people are excited about what the new technology can bring and kind of see only the upside. There's, you know, there's a lot of potential upside here, but nothing happens without, you know, there's always a roller coaster that happens as things sort of kind of find their normal. So I don't think we're going to see this level of spending keep going up and up and up the way we have. I think we're going to see it still stay strong next year because it's kind of already in the books. Beyond that, I think it's going to depend on how consumers and businesses, how much they're really using AI and how much demand there is that will determine the course for all these types of investments.
We will wait to see that. Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That is Dan Gallagher, a columnist for The Wall Street Journal covering the technology and media industries. We talked about the financing behind data centers and the potential risks in the spending race for AI applications. Now to look further into energy-intensive data centers and how local utilities are responding, we turn to Tom Content, executive director at the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. He's also vice president of the National Association of State Utility Consumer Advocates. Tom, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me on again.
Electricity bills, they're going up nationwide, including, as you know, here in Wisconsin. How much is this due to the AI data center boom?
Well, in other parts of the country, it actually is due to the data center boom. In states out east where they deregulated their power markets, we're seeing increases already. We're concerned about increases here. We know our bills have already been rising significantly in recent years at rates higher than inflation. But the concern is, will customers, homeowners, renters, small businesses, be footing the bill for the data centers, this wave of data centers that's now upon us?
We Energies is seeking to add 3 gigawatts and billions of dollars worth of energy projects to meet expected energy demands for data centers. What is your organization, Citizens Utility Board, watching for as data center firms make these deals with utility companies to increase energy output?
Yeah, we're concerned about the risks down the road, the risks from the AI bubble, as well as that Dan was talking about, as well as the risks of more efficient technology like we've seen in China being deployed more aggressively. Several companies in China have announced AI breakthroughs that are much less energy intensive. So we're watching that. And the reason we're watching that is when you pay for a power plant, it's paid as ratepayers, we're paying for that over 40 or 60 years. And so if AI companies' business plans change, We need to make sure that there are sufficient guarantees and exit fees and protections in place for the rest of the for the citizens of Wisconsin who will still be here if plans change for the tech companies.
I mean, 40 to 60 years, that's generations of Wisconsin residents who would be footing the bill for these utility upgrades. And, you know, can you talk about then, you know, for if a data center project, if they decide to pull back on their plans down the road or if their electricity needs change, how would that impact ratepayers?
Well, that's the question. Those are the questions, the exact questions that we're asking in a case that's just getting underway right now at the Public Service Commission. The We Energies has filed a plan. It's called a data center tariff. So it's the rates that that both the OpenAI and Oracle would pay in Port Washington and what Microsoft would pay in Racine County. And so we're in the thick of that, and we're trying to make sure that there are sufficient consumer protections and, as I said, exit fees in place. We're concerned that not all the I's have been dotted and all the T's have been crossed. And so this case is, I call it the most important case that isn't a rate case that we've ever undertaken in 46 years of CUB, given the magnitude of this. The scale of these data centers is just so immense in terms of their energy needs. And if just for We Energies alone, it took 120 years for We Energies customers to grow in their energy demand up to 5,000 megawatts of energy, of electricity. And these two projects all by themselves would double that using another 5,000 megawatts. It's amazing. It's daunting. It's daunting, I should say. And every time I say it, I'm still my jaw drops because these are orders of magnitude bigger numbers than the kind of economic development we used to see when we would land something like the new pharmaceutical factory in Kenosha County or another economic development project.
You mentioned exit fees, and I'm wondering what are some ways that utility companies could better protect ratepayers, better protect their customers with the data center industry and these deals?
Yeah, and this is where our involvement with this coalition of consumer advocates from other states is something we hope to bring back to Wisconsin for the benefit of ratepayers here. What we're learning is that a statewide approach is really helpful. There's a case in Ohio where Ohio actually got burned by crypto and Bitcoin mining companies that ended up leaving the state after the big utility had to invest in energy infrastructure for them. And so when the data centers came calling, and there's significant growth demand for data centers now in Ohio, the consumer advocate, our counterpart, Cub's counterpart in Ohio, and the utility worked together to negotiate a plan that was very protective for the customers of Ohio. The data center coalition opposed that. And after the Ohio regulators approved that plan, but then what happened after that is that a lot of the data center demand shifted from that utility to another, a different utility that didn't have those protections in place. So that's why it's important to have, to have a statewide framework. There's a bill in the legislature right now that would take steps toward implementing just that.
Microsoft has said it's prepaying for energy and electrical infrastructure that it'll use for their data center in Racine County. Is that attack that other data center projects around Wisconsin are also doing?
I believe that's the case for other projects, but I don't know for sure. But I know Microsoft is a special case in part because it's on the Foxconn site,
mm-hmm.
and there was the state laws were changed to enable energy infrastructure projects to move more quick to happen more quickly and without as much regulation, just in that one zone. So we're hopeful that's carrying over to the other projects. Having said that, there was a power line that was built for a transmission line that was built by ATC for Foxconn that is, was paid for by customers across the state, for not just We Energy's customers, not just Foxconn, but We Energy's customers, customers in Madison, even customers in up to Rhinelander and Michigan's Upper Peninsula ended up paying for that line, which now Microsoft is the beneficiary of.
Contracts between data centers and utility companies, they're very confidential. Is transparency an issue when you're looking at the energy demand with these projects and what protections would be fair and viable for ratepayers?
I think it's important that every, as you used to say in journalism, sunshine is the best disinfectant. Mm-hmm. And so the more awareness people have up front is clear. And we're seeing that now in the local dialogues that are happening around the state, where the agreements are being negotiated and kind of foisted on a public that is very confused and has a lot of questions about the long-term benefits, especially when you look at the results of the Marquette poll that came out just a few months ago. It was bipartisan. It didn't matter what party or if you were an independent. A majority of Wisconsinites at that time said that that the costs outweigh the benefits of adding data centers in our state.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Content is Executive Director of Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. That's a consumer watchdog for utility customers. We talked about how ratepayers might be affected if the energy demand for data centers isn't realized. And earlier, we heard from Wall Street Journal tech columnist Dan Gallagher about the financial portfolios of these data centers and what happens to these investments long term.
Coming up, a Wisconsin emotion researcher shares 50 ways to manage our emotional well-being.
There's lots of things we can do, big things and small things, that can have a really profound impact on our emotional life.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Even if you don't make formal New Year's resolutions, a lot of people take the new year as an opportunity to make some changes in life.
A new book from a Wisconsin researcher offers lots of advice that could help us kick off the new year with a look at how we handle our emotions.
At UW Green Bay, Ryan Martin studies the psychology of emotion. He's done a lot of work on anger and is known as the anger professor.
His new book tackles emotions more generally with lots of practical steps along the way. Ryan Martin is Dean of the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW-Green Bay. His new book is called Emotion Hacks, 50 Ways to Feel Better Fast. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I think a core concept that's really important here is the idea that we can have some sort of influence over our emotions. I think we might think emotions just happen to us or they don't, and there's nothing we can do about it. Make that case that, yes, in fact, we can step in and intervene on our own emotions.
Yeah, this is the sort of essentially the origin of the book is a conversation I had with someone on social media who said, look, if exercise doesn't work, he was talking about a very specific thing, I don't know what my options are. And it made me really sad because ultimately there are so many different options. There's lots of things we can do, big things and small things, that can have a really profound impact on our emotional life. And so the book is really about trying to share those ideas with people. Here are 50 different things that you can do to help manage your emotions once you fully understand how emotions work.
Let's get right into how emotions work. You give a summary in the book of kind of a chain of emotions. You call it the why we feel model. Can you briefly spell that out for us?
Yeah, ultimately, whenever we experience some sort of what I'm going to call a stimulus, but a provocation, something happening in our environment that sparks an emotion, there's a couple of different elements here, right? There's that stimulus itself. So maybe you get stuck in traffic, or maybe you see a scary movie, or maybe you lose something that you care about, right? There's that stimulus. And then there's our mood at the time that we experience that. So are we hungry? Are we tired? Are we stressed? And then there's our interpretation of that stimulus. So, you know, how do we interpret? How do we appraise? How do we make sense of it? And what I want people to understand is that there are different interventions at each and every one of those points. There are things we can do to thoughtfully engage with the world so that we are being clear about what stimuli we are inadvertently inviting into our life. There are ways we can take care of ourselves so that our mood at the time that we experience those stimuli can help us feel better about things. There's different ways we can interpret those stimuli. There's different things we can do when we're emoting, and there's different ways we can express it. And all of those can be choices that we make in our day-to-day life.
And some of the hacks, many of the hacks are kind of in the moment things. You start with a few that are big picture, kind of like basic maintenance. And one that I love is paying attention to our mood, even when we're not mm-hmm. feeling a negative emotion, but being in touch with what our mood is and having that be ready for that when that stimulus happens. How can we be in better touch with what our current mood is?
Yeah, I think it's really, really important for people to pay attention to how they are feeling in a given moment and understanding that that feeling influences how you respond to some sort of stimuli. So if I am really stressed out or already angry about something or really tired, and then I experience that delay in traffic or some other sort of seemingly negative thing, it feels so much worse to me. But just being able to name the fact that it feels worse because of the mood I'm currently in, well, that is going to help me deal with it. So if I can say, this feels worse because I am tired, or this feels worse because I'm stressed or hungry or whatever, that makes a difference in how we experience that provocation or whatever it is.
Let's take that to that next step. We've recognized, hey, our moods change, and I can definitely vouch for this. My reaction to, say, knocking over a glass of water, I might laugh at myself if I was in a good mood. I might swear at the glass because it's the glass's fault, right? If I'm in a bad mood, how in that moment I knock over the glass, I realize I'm going to be irrationally annoyed. How do I step in that moment?
Yeah, this is one of the hardest parts about managing our emotions, is figuring out how to intervene in the moment when we've experienced this sort of negative thing. And we get better at it when we practice. And so a big piece of this is the need to practice and be prepared for that. And one of the things I really encourage people to do is be aware when they are what we call catastrophizing. So you use the example of knocking over a glass of water. We can think about what are the realistic consequences of this. A lot of times we blow things out of proportion, we catastrophize, we make a big deal out of this. But in reality, there's a difference between that kind of irritation and something that is truly catastrophic. And so one of the things I encourage people to do is, first of all, whenever you experience something, there's going to be a moment where you're maybe a little bit irrational. And that's okay. Like, you can take that moment. And then once you're starting to recover from that, think through intentionally, okay, what are the consequences here? In the case of the glass of water, hey, I got to grab a towel and clean this up, right? Hopefully I didn't ruin anything permanently. Over time, people are going to get better. If you're doing that and being intentional about that, it's going to become more of a habit for you to actually reflect on that in the moment, and you'll cut down that irrationality moment considerably.
We're talking to UW Green Bay psychologist Ryan Martin about his new book. It's called Emotion Hacks, 50 Ways to Feel Better Fast. Ryan, you also dig into more consequential moments that might have emotions in our life, like me knocking over a glass of water, not a big deal. But you say, you know, there are real problems that can make us sad, mm-hmm. losing a job, losing a relationship, and so on. And it seems like a lot of the work here is is finding a sweet spot. You don't want to deny the emotions that come with that. You don't want those emotions to ruin you, basically. What are some of the hacks to take that legitimately troubling event and come out of that?
One of the things we know is that suppression or denying your feelings is also going to be a problem. And so it's a problem to blow things out of proportion. It's also a problem to minimize. And so part of managing your emotions is having that realistic understanding of how bad something is. But not just that, having a realistic understanding of why it happened, who's responsible, you know, including yourself and how responsible you are for something. And I think it's part of why that's so important is because that, again, gives you a sense of what you can do next. How do you intervene in this? How do you channel those emotions? And so, for instance, if you identify like, hey, this bad thing has happened, it is legitimately bad, and I am largely responsible for it. Well, we should use maybe the guilt or shame or disappointment you're feeling as a way of like kind of channeling that into some self-improvement approaches or making up for the problem and so on. If you determine, though, hey, this is really driven by some sort of, I don't know, systemic problems at my work, some things that are not working correctly that led to this negative outcome, well, then you can channel some of that emotional feeling and the energy it provides into solving those structural problems at work.
And one of the worst things you could say to someone in that situation is something along the lines of look on the bright side. But part of our tactic in getting through that isn't saying, well, look on the bright side, find all the positive, but can I take something positive? What can I take to move ahead here? It's a fine line in some ways, but a really important one.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. A lot of times when we think about some of the positive reappraisal approaches that we use, some of those things can end up feeling pretty minimizing. And so we have to be really careful in what we tell ourselves and what we tell other people. And so, you know, one of the things I talk about is putting things into perspective. And another version of this is the sort of, hey, look, it could be worse, right?
I laugh because this was my thing for dealing with negative emotion. Other people have things worse right now, so quit being a baby. That was not a successful perspective strategy as I read your book.
I mean, ultimately, it can be. But in the moment, especially right after a loss or a frustration, that isn't a thing that ever really makes people feel good, right? It's sort of like saying to someone, hey, calm down. Or, you know, another version is like if my son walks off the soccer field after a bad game and I say to him, hey, it could, you know, it's only a game or something like that. There may come a point, though, as you're navigating these, that putting things into perspective is a good, healthy thing to do, where you can start to think, okay, we got to remember the scope of this. How bad is this? And I think, again, the same thing can be said for refocusing on some of the positive elements. That's a good, healthy thing to do, but not in a way that's dishonest, not in a way that minimizes some of the very real negatives that are there. You know, what I often tell people is, of course, it could be worse, right? Things can always be worse, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't bad right now. And so focusing too much on that can be unhealthy.
And let me be clear, that stop whining is my self-talk. I didn't say that to other people. And that leads to another thing. Sometimes the strategy is, okay, you're saying this to yourself. If your friend or a loved one came to you with this problem, is that what you'd say to them? Like, put yourself in that third person perspective to get that perspective we're looking for.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And one of the things I talk about is trying to take that broader view and imagine how this story might be from another person's perspective. What would they say about it? Sometimes taking a moment, especially when you're feeling pretty intensely and sort of trying to distance yourself from the situation, can offer you some really important perspective that way.
Here's one that I think people might, you say in the book, people push back on some. Ask yourself if the feeling is valid. And you write, like in pop culture, hey, all of our emotions are valid. And you say, well, hold on. How do we sort that out?
Yeah, this is a place that my take isn't particularly popular here, but I stand by it. Not all emotions are valid. And I want to qualify that as saying emotions are real, all of them. And so they absolutely exist, and they are absolutely something you are experiencing. Some of this comes down to how people define valid. But from my perspective, you know, by definition, some emotions are invalid. We're going to use the most obvious example of this, phobias, which is this intense fear response to a specific thing. Those are by definition unreasonable, which is at least my definition of the word valid, right? We should listen to them. We should absolutely pay attention to them, but we should acknowledge that they aren't necessarily coming from a healthy, reasonable place. And part of what it means to have a healthy emotional life is to know when they're coming from a reasonable place or when they're coming from an unreasonable place. And when they're coming from an unreasonable place, we've got to be honest with ourselves about that and then try and navigate what that means.
Another one that, well, it's one of the starting points from your book. You touched on it briefly earlier. We think, I'm angry. I'm going to exercise that anger off. And the research says, no, that doesn't really work.
Yeah. So exercise is one of the more complicated elements here. And that is because exercise when you're not emoting. So under normal circumstances, it is a super, super important and valuable aspect of emotion management. It is good to exercise. In fact, there's some research that says it outperforms medication as a therapeutic option. It is something people should absolutely be doing for their emotional well-being. However, when you are highly emotional, when you're really angry or when you're really scared, a lot of times people say, well, I like to go to the gym and work that off. That has typically been found not to be effective, especially really vigorous exercise. So going for a run, hitting a punching bag, that kind of emotional expression ends up keeping those angry thoughts or those anxious thoughts kind of at the surface. It keeps your heart rate elevated at a time where what you might need is to decrease your heart rate. So alternatives to that that are still kind of similar to exercise are maybe going for a walk, something that doesn't necessarily get your heart rate going but gets you out and about.
And briefly, the exercise is part of some of the first few tips in the book, taking good physical care of ourselves, including staying hydrated. There's research that shows that, hey, if I drank that glass of water instead of knocking it over, I'm going to be emotionally in better shape.
Yep, absolutely. So, this is a good one for a lot of people. That there's plenty of research out there that says even mild dehydration impacts your mood. And so making a point of taking good care of yourself by eating well, by prioritizing sleep, again, exercising, staying hydrated, being careful about what you drink can really influence your mood in a positive way.
We'll leave it there. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ryan Martin, professor and researcher at UW-Green Bay. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Emotion Hacks, 50 Ways to Feel Better Fast. Venezuelans around the world and here in Wisconsin are reacting to the news of the U.S. capturing and prosecuting the ousted leader of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro.
Following the military operation on Caracas over the weekend, President Trump has said the U.S. would run Venezuela, and we want to know how you are responding to these developments.
What do you think of Maduro and his wife being captured by U.S. forces and removed from the country? What are your thoughts on this kind of American intervention?
Are you from South America, or do you have ties to Venezuela? How does this news impact you or your community here in Wisconsin?
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson and Beatrice Lawrence.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.